word.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the inaugural Post Bougie podcast for the week of January 17th, 2010. This is Shawnee O in central New Jersey, and today I'm joined by Post Bougie contributor and policy wonk Jamel, who is in Charlottesville, VA.
Hello, hello.
And we have PB proprietor GD, who's in Brooklyn, New York.
What's going on?
And we have our resident series journalist Monica, who is live and direct from the nation's capital.
Hello.
So we're going to talk about a few things today. First up is Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and his comments recorded in the book Game Change, which include a most unfortunate combination of the words Barack Obama, Negro, and light skin. Second, we'll talk some more about the wreckage from Game Change, since the account of the 2008 campaign also manages to knock progressive hero Elizabeth Edwards off her pedestal. And topic number three is about the possible Senate run of the Tennessean cum New Yorker, Harold Ford Jr., a man who's proud to have flown over the five boroughs by helicopter.
He's also a light-skinned Negro, too.
That's a good point. And lastly, we'll close with shout-outs to whatever it is we think is awesome this week. Okay, so let's just get right into topic number one. Jamel, can you sort this out for us? Harry Reid, is he racist, old, or just dumb?
Okay, well, it's worth, I mean, I'm sure everyone listening has read the remark, but it's worth saying it just for the sake of the podcast. Here is the exact line from Halperin and the other guy's book, Game Change. Harry Reid said he was wowed by Obama's oratorical gifts and believed that the country was ready to embrace a black presidential candidate, especially one such as Obama, a, quote, light-skinned African-American with, quote, no Negro dialect, unless he wanted to have one, as he said privately. Reid was convinced, in fact, that Obama's race would help him more than hurt him in a bid for the Democratic nomination. So, you know, clearly using the word Negro and referring to President Obama's light skin is not the best choice of words. But as a lot of people pointed out, Harry Reid essentially saying something very, very banal, and that something we all know, and that something that was even discussed during the campaign, which is that the fact that Barack Obama is of mixed race, and the fact that he does or can like ably code switch between you know, what is an African American dialect and sort of mainstream English is a great political asset. It makes him a lot more palatable. You know, the listeners can't see me, but I'm pretty dark skinned, and if I had I guess you know what you would think of as an African American dialect or accent, you better believe that my chances at a political career would be definitely stunted, especially one where I had to appeal to white people.
So I guess it's not really ironic, because irony is something that you don't expect, but the Republicans calling for Harry Reid to resign.
Well, you can. This is nitpicking, but you can expect irony, right?
No, I thought the definition of irony was something that, like, the last thing you expected, or like.
No, that's the Alanis Morissette definition of irony.
Yeah, it drives everyone insane.
Yeah, no, that's not what irony is. Irony is not.
The Alanis Morissette song is not actually.
Spoons when you need a knife.
The Alanis Morissette song was ironic because it wasn't ironic.
Exactly, it's like meta-irony.
The things she was saying were not actually ironic.
All right. Anyway.
They just sucked, yeah.
So, the irony is the last leg, is something that you don't expect. I remember this distinctly from teaching Mrs. Tingle.
Anyway.
Right, what the all right, anyway.
Okay, so, you totally interrupted me. I was making a good point here.
You were about to mention something about the Republicans with regard to Harry Reid.
Right. I'm sorry. I'm looking at the definition of irony. All right. Anyway. So, it's an outcome of events contrary to what was expected. So, the last thing you expected. Okay. So, as I was saying, it's very interesting that the Republicans, I don't even know what my thought was now. Never mind. Somebody else have something to say about this?
I mean, I think I know where you're going. I think you know where you're going, and that's right, that the Republicans immediately began calling for Harry Reid's resignation, and they cited a double standard with Mississippi Senator Trent Lott, who in 2003 or 2002 at a birthday celebration for Strom Thurmond said that had we elected Senator Thurmond, we wouldn't have all these problems we had after, you know, presumably after Thurmond was elected. And Republicans seem to, that really, you know, they're really, really still kind of angry about that. But it's not at all a one-to-one. It's not very similar. You know, Harry Reid is saying a pretty standard fact, like standard sociological reality about the United States, whereas Trent Lott is praising a man who in 1948, when he ran for president, ran explicitly to preserve segregation in the South.
Right.
And then caps it off with saying that had we elected that man, had we elected a man who pledged to preserve segregation, then we wouldn't have all those problems. He hasn't ever really defined what he meant by those problems, but I think it's safe to say that what he meant was that we wouldn't have black people acting all uppity.
I think that's a fair thing to say. And something else that I've seen a few places is that people are saying, in response to this Republican complaint that Trent Lott was run off because of this comment he made, was that Trent Lott was not actually in favor at the time, and it was strategic for the Republicans to get rid of him.
Yeah, that was really why he was they didn't want him to be majority leader anymore, and that was really why. The firestorm was convenient, but it wasn't really the reason.
One of the funny things about that whole controversy was that that Trent Lott was praising a Republican senator who had been a Republican senator in good standing for a long time, and his praise of him was what got him in trouble. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he had managed to sit in the upper chamber of our legislature for 50 something years, right? And he was an avowed racist and a segregationist. And when somebody went to praise him, that was enough fuel to get this, like, that was a catalyst for this cat to get kicked out of Congress. I thought it was hilarious.
And so the Republicans who are calling for Harry Reid's resignation are not. They weren't calling for Strom Thurmond's resignation.
Right, exactly.
And they're saying is that Harry Reid is being racist.
Yeah. Moreover, like even when Strom Thurmond died, people didn't even really. It was like in the fourth paragraph of all the obituaries that he had like interesting thoughts about race, you know, and that he was like a racist, like he had political problems after, you know what I mean? It was like this kind of elusive way of referring to the fact that he was a racist. Nobody ever said it,
even though his entire like political success was due to the fact that he
like played on racial fears and
right. Mm-hmm. That's nice.
I think some of the Harry Reid stuff, I mean, Republicans are calling for his resignation, but I think some of the reason that it really kind of caught on as news is just because Harry Reid is having his own problems.
There are legitimate reasons why he should resign.
Yeah, he's having his own problems really being a strong majority leader and trying to run for re-election in Nevada. So I think that is part of the reason this caught on as a narrative that Harry Reid is embattled now, you know?
Right. Yeah. It's so funny because I think that Harry Reid has had some issues. Like you said, he's had some issues doing his job, and there are other reasons why he should be worried, less so than, you know, calling Al Sharpton to get confirmation that he wasn't being racist. So.
Yeah, I think that's part of the problem is I think that especially people in the Republican Party talk so little about race at all that, like, anytime you mention race, it must be, like it's kind of this weird thing. It's like they just assume that Harry Reid mentioning something to do with race is automatically racist. But then if they said something that was actually racist and you called them out on it, then that would be really wrong of you to do so.
Because you're not being colorblind.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I don't think that's that issue is specific to the Republican Party, though. I mean, I think that's the way we talk about race in this country. Like, the larger conversation about race is that it's hard to talk about race in this country at all without being accused of being a racist or being someone who's obsessed with race. And I don't know that, as Jamel said, that anything Reed said was that horrible. But I guess what I wanted to ask all of you guys was whether anyone took issue with the Negro comment, because that seemed to be the thing that everyone in my circle of the world had their hackles up about.
I mean, I don't know. I'm sort of, it wasn't, you know, a bad choice of words, right? But, you know, Reed, the man's 70 years old for the better part of his adult life. For actually exactly half of his adult life, Negro is the accepted term for African Americans. And so while he probably shouldn't have used it, I could see how it just comes out in, like, you know, regular private conversation. Like, that's probably what he used for, you know, 20, 30 years.
Right. I don't see that there's anything inherently offensive about using the term Negro other than it being an archaic word for Black or African American. But, I mean, would have been better if he'd said colored. Like, or would it have been worse? I don't think so. He didn't say, you know, the, you know, horrible evil N-word that everybody draws back in horror at. So I think that would have been a problem. But Negro, eh.
But okay, so, I mean, and this isn't a perfect parallel, but I have family members who say Oriental, which is unacceptable, you know what I mean? But I think it speaks to kind of very limited exposure that people have with people who are not like them. And it's an unfortunate choice of words on Reed's part, but I don't know that it was necessarily malicious. Or, I mean, you know, we always have this conversation whether malice or ill intent matters, but it certainly doesn't seem to, it just seems like just a kind of atavism from a time in which that was the popular terminology.
Yeah, I was going to, my family members all say Oriental too until I finally beat them over the head and got them to say Asian. But like now I worry about what happens if it changes again and Asian is not okay anymore. Because, and I kind of feel like that might be what happened with Reed. Like at some point in his life, he probably had it battered into his head that he should say Negro. And so it's like now it's like too old. He's too old. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I certainly think that it behooves him to
use the proper terminology.
Right, absolutely. I mean, I think if you
there's get, nothing wrong with using the right word.
But I also think, I mean, if it was a private conversation.
So if he was only using Negro because it was a private conversation, then that speaks more to malice, though.
Or not like, malice.
If in public he would have said a Black dialect or an African American dialect, but in private he goes Negro dialect, then that's a problem. Because that means he knows better.
I don't know. I mean, I think if in public he had said Black or African American dialect, he would have received a lot of fire too, exactly for the reasons that GD described, which is that any mention of race becomes like de facto racist. I don't know if you guys saw the bit with Liz Cheney and George Will, where Liz Cheney says something to the effect of, he talked about the president's race, that's clearly racist. And it's like, you don't know what that word means, do you?
Yes, that goes back to the colorblindness thing. Like, if you don't talk about race at all, like, you can say things that are horribly racist without actually saying, like, a word that's, like, a trigger word for race, like Negro or Black. You're okay. Like, you're in the clear.
And I think it's worth noting that none of this means that Reed is not a racist. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Reed could very well hate Black people to the core of his soul, but this doesn't prove it.
All right, we're going to move on to topic number two. So Elizabeth Edwards was completely deified by the left for three things that have happened to her. One, her son died. Two, she was diagnosed with incurable cancer. And three, her husband cheated on her. So, Monica, why has the perception of her as the saint of the left been shaken so badly lately?
Well, it's again that Eva Volan is again game change. An excerpt of the book was published in New York Magazine, and it was headlined to Saint Elizabeth and the Ego Monster. And it's this really awful tale of the downfall of the Edwards campaign, which we all knew was problematic anyway. But in it, Elizabeth really comes off as like this kind of horrible candidate's wife who's like always screaming at the staffers and yelling at her husband and being really like flaky in some ways too, where she's in some ways she's really supportive and then she'll turn around and be the opposite of supportive. And then when the allegations that, maybe he's had an affair and fathered the child of this woman, Riel Hunter, start to come out in the Inquirer, she kind of like alternately believes and disbelieves. And she comes across as just this like yelling, crazy person who kind of at the height, the climax of her craziness, according to the piece, in a terminal, airport terminal, she confronts her husband and like rips open her shirt to show her scarred body. I assume she's had a double mastectomy to treat her breast cancer. And it really strikes me as unfair because it's like, I don't know, we'll talk about why I think it's unfair as we get to into the discussion, but she just comes across as just really horrible and unstable. And it seems particularly calculated on the part of the writers to break down the saintly image that she had, which you alluded to, but it has to do with, you know, her really tragic past, her son who died when he was 16, and then her husband keeps putting her through this bullshit and like continues to run for president after she's diagnosed with terminal cancer and then cheats on her. And she wrote a book last year called Resilience, and it was kind of, you know, one of those Oprah books. So,
right. You know what I found so creepy kind of about the whole Elizabeth Edwards mythology is that you just had these people kind of falling at her feet in terms of talking about how wonderful she was. And yeah, she does seem like a resilient person, but the fact that she was put on this pedestal just seemed ridiculous to me. And I can see why, like in the piece, it's clear that they're trying to break down this idea of who she was, but the idea of who she was the real problem, in my opinion, not like her being a real person. The problem is that people made her into this saint.
Mm-hmm.
Well, two things. She benefited from the idea of who she was, right? And what if, and we don't know how true any of this is, obviously. I mean, but what if it's all true? Does that matter at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think it matters a little bit because it could all be entirely true, but I think it matters the window that the writers chose to show you it, because I actually absolutely believe it all true. I'm sure she did yell at staffers, but I think it's probably more attributable to the fact that she's stuck in this really horrible marriage and is dying, and she's actually a real human, and so she's going to have real responses to that. And so I think the fact that she gets upset during a conference call when she figures out that she doesn't have health care is actually completely, or I mean health insurance, is actually a completely reasonable response to her situation. And I think the way that it's presented is problematic in the piece.
Yeah, I mean, I would only add to that, I don't understand what they were expecting. I mean, politicians and their families are people, and so of course there are going to be circumstances when they get very angry and they get very exasperated and so on and so forth. And so the whole thing just smacks as being kind of stupid. Like, shockingly, politicians get angry, you know.
And
to everyone's surprise,
yeah,
a long-suffering political wife might be upset about something.
I know, like, Game Change is supposed to be kind of sensational, I guess, but the terminology that they use just to describe her, or her behavior, you know, she snarled and, you know, was brutal, and they just really make her look very, like, feral in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. And there's also a part, too, where they have this really kind of very snide sentence where they say, at first her illness seemed to mellow her, or something like that. I'm trying to find it exactly, but it's very cavalier, I think, about her illness. Like, at first, this thing that she's dying from seems to make her mellow, but then that disappears.
Yeah, right. In 2005. Yeah. So it said, it says Elizabeth's illness seemed at first to mellow her in the early months of 2005, but not for long.
Yeah, that really made me angry.
Yeah. They really treat her very poorly here. And I was never like a huge fan of hers anyway. I kind of was creeped out by the whole, she's a wonderful person because of these things that have happened to her. Which just seems like what you see so often when it comes to women in the public eye, just like Jenny Sanford is getting completely, you know, being treated like such an interesting person because her husband cheated on her.
Yeah, yeah. To show endurance, women have to be put through really, like, hellish situations. That's the only... I was like, oh, she's such a strong woman because she's dying. You know, it's like...
right. Yeah. Like, she survived so much. Whereas, like, you know, a man doesn't need to have, like, lost so much to be interesting.
Yeah. And I think also part of the problem, and this is part of the problem, I think, with Reed's comments, too, and everything else that's come out, is, like, kind of scandalous about Game Change. And don't get me wrong, I think the piece was really, like, riveting. I read the whole thing really fast. And even when I got mad, I was just, like, compelled to continue reading. So I think it does its job of being, like, a page-turner, but doesn't, you know, add much beyond that. But I think the bigger problem, which I think Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote about a lot, was that... you know, you really don't know how much to trust the writers. It really seems that they've cobbled together the narrative that they weren't there to witness from many different sources. And so, you know, of course, all these aides are telling them these things. They have to come up with a reason they lost, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, and that's true of every losing campaign. The only people who seem unscathed are the Obamas. And it's, of course they are, because they won. So they're... aides don't have to go through and search for the narrative of why they failed at doing their job of getting somebody elected.
No, that makes complete sense. And even the way they describe Riel, and, you know, she flirted outlandishly with every man she met. It was just like, I don't know, the sensationalism in it really, and the way the women are particularly written is kind of troublesome to me.
But I'm not trying to defend the book. I haven't read it. But don't campaign postmortems always come off this way? Aren't they always a little bit salacious and gossipy? And
they are to an extent. I mean, there is the Newsweek postmortem, How Obama Won.
Right.
Which came out, I guess, about a year ago, right?
Right.
And... it definitely had that kind of salacious feel to it, but it wasn't,
I think,
quite like this.
I think maybe part of what we're reacting to then is that there are more, just more women in the, even if they're not necessarily in the highest, I mean, Palin being the obvious exception, but like, and Hillary Clinton as well, but like there are a lot more women kind of who are more integral to the stories of the campaign, if that makes sense, you know? They're not like, props.
So there are more women to write poorly, basically.
Well, yeah. right, exactly. Like, I mean...
because it's still men who are writing these things.
Right, but now you... I mean, this time... I mean, it's easy to forget this now, but... you know, Hillary Clinton's campaign was a historic campaign, you know? And Sarah Palin being nominated to be John McCain's running mate is a really, really big deal. And so there are all these women who... were like integral to the narratives of the campaign.
So it's the women's fault, is that what you're saying?
No, not at all.
There weren't so many women.
No, not at all. But I'm saying.
No, I'm joking. Yeah.
I mean,
no, I know what you're saying.
I mean, I still don't think we know what to do with those people just yet. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Okay. Fair enough.
I could be talking about my ass, please. I mean. I'm just saying, I just popped in my head.
If you are, I'm sure our commenters will let us know.
Please do.
Topic 3. So, everyone knows, New Yorkers love people who aren't from New York. GD, please tell us why Harold Ford is getting such a hard time as he explores a bid for the Senate.
Okay, so Harold Ford, who first came to national prominence in his bid to become Tennessee's senator back in 06, has been publicly flirting with another run here in New York. Against Kirsten Gillibrand, who was appointed to fill the Senate seat vacated by Hillary Clinton when she took over the State Department. T- Tennessee is obviously a whole lot redder than New York is. And Ford is catching a lot of heat from folks on the left for some of the stances he took when he ran for Senate the last time. Here's a clip from an ad that's already airing that is attacking Ford for some of the stuff he said in the past.
Harold Ford Jr. is pro-gun.
I joined the NRA because I believe every American man and woman has the right to defend themselves and their loved ones. And just because you're outside your home, it doesn't mean you give up your right to protect yourself.
Anti-choice.
I voted for parental notification.
I'm pro-life, Tucker. So, I mean, I don't run from that.
I was not pro-choice at one time.
You oppose same-sex marriage.
You support the president's call for a constitutional amendment to ban marriage between gays.
Blue dog.
I'm Harold Ford Jr. And to get control of our borders, we've got to get tough on illegals.
Ford has already had a disastrous interview with the New York Times in which he came across as a pretty effete prima donna. I'm going to quote from the article here. Speaking from a conference room at New York University where he's a teacher, Mr. Ford, 39, expressed enthusiasm about his new hometown, though he described a life quite different than most New Yorkers. On many days, he's driven to an NBC television studio in a chauffeured car. He and his wife, Emily, a 29-year-old fashion executive, live a few blocks from the Lexington Avenue subway line in the Flatiron District, but Mr. Ford said he takes the subway only occasionally in the winter to avoid the cold when he cannot hail a cab. Asked whether he had visited all five boroughs, he mentioned taking a helicopter ride across the city with fellow executives at the invitation of Ray Kelly, New York City's police commissioner. The only place I have not spent considerable time is Staten Island, adding that I landed there in the helicopter, so I can say yes. He has breakfast most mornings at the Regency Hotel on Park Avenue, and he receives regular pedicures. He described them as treatment for a foot condition. So here's my very, very weighty question to all of y'all. Do you think Harold Ford can code switch?
I think he can probably go southern. He can probably go really southern.
But it's like...
But I don't know if he can go like... But it's like NRA southern.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's too light-skinned for all that.
It's like NASCAR or something.
No, what I want to know is how much money does this dude have?
I mean, apparently Bank of America is paying him like $1 million a year.
Yeah, did he least. Get did he get a bonus from the TARP funds, or was it the TARP funds?
Are my taxpayer dollars still going to Harold Ford?
His pedicures? Actually, I heard on WNYC, I think Brian Lehrer's show, they were talking about that, and people are investigating to find out if he got a bonus from the bailout funds. So that won't be good.
I mean, the problem with Harold Ford, I mean, aside from the fact that he's kind of ridiculous, he's slimy, you know, all the he's shamelessly dishonest, you know, all that notwithstanding, the problem is that it's just a waste of a seat, right? Like, a New York Democrat is supposed to be a reliably liberal vote. If you're a senator from New York, you basically are signing on to the Democratic Party's, like, liberal priorities. Harold Ford, however, is not a liberal. In fact, his entire national brand is around the fact that he is this, you know, kind of conservative black dude from Tennessee who, you know, is comfortable in the NRA rally and all that jazz. And so if he were to, you know, if he were to run, let's say he won the primary and he were to win, we'd have a senator who, you know, judging from his past, his performance in the House, and judging from his rhetoric, would be more than comfortable, you know, playing the Joe Lieberman role or playing the Ben Nelson role. And from every indication, he seemed like someone who had positioned himself to the right of those folks. So, you know, like...
So a more obstructionist Joe Lieberman, basically.
Right. I mean, for political reasons, like, you know, giving a seat to Harold Ford is effectively like giving another vote to the Republicans, as far as I'm concerned.
I think that sounds about right, but I mean, honestly, what's the likelihood that New York voters are going to embrace this guy?
Oh yeah, I mean, absolutely not at all.
I mean, granted, Gillibrand has her own issues, right?
Yeah, but she's kind of moving a little bit to the left, and also I think that New Yorkers kind of have like a bit of inertia as well, you know? So it's like, they would have voted for Kennedy if Kennedy had been appointed and ran again, even if she, you know what I mean? Like, just because it's like, oh, Caroline Kennedy, you know, they just want somebody who is going to generally be pretty liberal.
Right. So this was like, this Times piece was like, it, they did not go easy on him at all. It was really harsh.
It was really mean. There was a bit of editorializing as well. Like, not that I don't appreciate it, but I feel like some of the things, just even in the quote that you read, GD, wouldn't have been necessarily allowed if it was in a parallel profile of like a conservative, because they would have been sensitive to that criticism. So it's like speaking from the back of his pickup truck. Like, I don't know if that would have worked for like somebody from the South. Do you know what I mean?
But clearly he volunteered all of this information. You know what I mean? Like, I don't catch the damn train. You know, I mean, it's weird. I mean, this is kind of ridiculous. The people don't live here, but like New Yorkers have a particular obsession with the subway. Like, Mike Bloomberg, who is the richest man in New York City, takes his SUV to the train station every morning so he can appear to be, you know, put on this like proletarian jacket every morning and appear to be a regular New Yorker, even though that's completely ridiculous. And so the idea that Harold Ford helicopters around the four boroughs, he's never been to Staten Island, but nobody has, you know, it's like
he said he landed in Staten Island.
Right. Yeah, he said he landed. Yeah, I mean, but there's no reason to spend time there, which is a bigger point.
Yeah.
It's not horrible. Staten Island is beautiful.
Iron Fist, who would want to go?
Shout out to Staten Island. Yo, I'm gonna hold Staten Island down. Okay,
why?
Because it's pretty.
Yeah, no.
It smells like trash. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And you live
no,
in Jersey too. That's going hard for some.
Staten Island would be pretty to you.
Oh, guys, you're so funny.
Yeah, no, I think what Jamel said is the big, like, if he actually like wanted to go into the Senate and be useful because he's doing this for like altruistic reasons, or even if he just wanted to go to the Senate and be powerful to like maximize his own self-worth, he would be better off in Tennessee.
Absolutely. Right.
So when he talked about why he didn't, like, he gave this whole roundabout explanation of why he, like, he thought about running for governor in Tennessee, and then, you know, but this was home to his fiance at the time, and he didn't really explain why New York. He just kind of said, like, why not Tennessee?
It doesn't make any sense to me either, because it's not like Bob Corker beat him bad. Like, he lost to Bob Corker by, I think, 3 percentage points.
So he had a chance.
If in a Democratic favorable year, Harold Ford, I think, would have another shot at the Senate in Tennessee, he would have a shot at governor in Tennessee. But I don't know. I mean, I guess I think he's bored. I mean, honestly,
that's the only thing I can think of. The guy, you know, has breakfast at a hotel every morning and gets pedicures. What else is he gonna do but toss his hat into the ring? Although he hasn't officially said he's gonna run, he's just thinking about it, right?
Wake up in the morning feeling like P. Diddy.
I wonder if he has someone like carry him around.
Exactly, with the umbrella.
Like, I'm coming to America, somebody helping him gargle.
Right.
You know, what he didn't mention in that profile is when he goes to breakfast, he brings a helper with him to actually chew the food.
Okay, so this is the part where we just say mean things about Harold.
It's really, really hard to find nice things to say about Harold Ford. I mean, he comes across as this like really preening, arrogant dude who's not really big on policy, and they just kind of say whatever he wants. I mean, whatever he has to say in a given moment. He's really oleaginous. I mean, you know.
And worst of all, he hasn't actually earned any of it. He just happened to be like the oldest son of a longtime Tennessee politician.
Right, exactly. He was born into, he's a scion of a political family. You know, it's like, my heart bleeds.
That also must be why he has no idea how stupid it was for him to say those things.
Yeah,
it,
like, there's no reason. His handlers should have let him, I don't know, I'm not even sure if he has handlers at this point, but there's no reason his handlers should have let him do the whole subway thing and talk about flying around the helicopter. You know, I mean, it's like, come on, man. Like, that was, I'm sure as he was saying that, he knew he was fucking up.
I don't know if he knew, because he just doesn't come across as somebody who's really self-aware. I mean, if I like had grown up regularly taking helicopter rides to see the shit I wanted to see, I'd be like, oh yeah, I saw it in a helicopter ride, it was awesome, you know. I guess
I think twice about it. Like, yeah. Okay, well, I guess we'll wrap that our conversation about Harold Ford Jr. up. Best of luck, Mr. Ford.
Oh, so. Here's the little funny tidbit in the story is that he actually donated money to Gillibrand, to her campaign, or to
Who
her.
Didn't donate money to that woman? Seriously.
Yeah, I mean, he said, to be fair, it was 2 days after she was named the senator, so she got the, but come on.
Yeah.
Also, this kind of goes back to the...
Keep going.
No, but this goes back to the Harry Ford conversation. Like, all these cats are light-skinned. Cory Booker, Deval Patrick, Barack Obama. I mean, I got into arguments mm-hmm. this week about whether Barack Obama was light-skinned or not. But
I had that conversation too, actually.
He seems pretty light-skinned.
I'd say he's medium.
Yeah, he's like Shani's complexion.
Well, I mean, the other thing that nobody ever talked about in the Reed thing, too, is that, like, he was completely raised by white people. So, like, all the pictures of him and his family were, like, him with, like, white people.
No,
you know what I mean?
Point. That's a really good point.
So that, more than his own skin tone, I think that makes him accessible to white America, you know?
Right, which is why the majority of, I think, white Democrats view him as mixed race.
Yeah.
As opposed to black.
Is that true?
I just heard that as part of a... poll by CNN, I believe, they did a poll on feelings about race in America or something.
Do we then do we know whether or not that is because they don't want him to be black, or is it because of our evolving ideas about racial identity?
I don't know, but what was interesting is the majority of black people think he's black.
I mean, the fact that black people and white people have very different opinions on race does not surprise me at all.
And yet, they do polls on this and report on it as though, whoa, every black person isn't in love with America. Wow. News alert. So, okay. Well, anyway. So, lastly, we're going to go around and do shout-outs to whatever's getting us jazzed this week. So, Jamel, what are you shouting out this week?
Not so much a shout out as a shout down.
So wait, is this something that's not awesome?
No, it's not awesome. In fact, I hate it. But I hate it so much it's worth highlighting to all the wonderful listeners.
Okay, go ahead.
So I every Thursday with some friends and such, we go to one of the buffets in Charlottesville. We've been trying to hit up all the buffets, and we've hit up all the good ones. And so now we're going to like the third tier buffets, or like Golden Corral's and gross places. And today we went to Pizza Hut buffet because apparently everyone in this group hates that we hate ourselves a lot.
That's horrible. Sounds horrible.
It was quite possibly the worst meal I've had in like a decade.
Actually,
I'm 22.
So it's like half his life.
Half my life. Worst meal.
I actually forgot that Pizza Hut had buffets.
See, I did too.
And I didn't know they did.
And we were like, wow, pizza is a buffet. Let's go because, you know.
What do they have? Like, what kind of food do they have at the Pizza Hut buffet?
There's pizza. Clearly, pizza.
So it's a pizza buffet. Gross.
There's pasta.
Uh-huh. Salad.
There was no salad.
You know, Pizza Hut was like the only restaurant at all in my hometown after the Burger Broil closed. So like we occasionally had to go to Pizza Hut, and I remember the pasta being like in water still. Was that true for you? It was was water in the pan.
I didn't eat any, but I looked at it. And it just looked kind of like, I mean, it looked like just like bad pasta, but not like particularly underprepared or anything.
Monica, do you want to do your shout out?
I am actually going to shout out Brother, I'm Dying by Advij Dantekat, because I read it a while ago, but also because of all the trauma in Haiti, I think it's really worth revisiting. Probably its most famous writer, but it's a really fantastic book. It's a biography of her family, basically. And she brings to bear the same kind of sense of style and place that she does in her fiction, but it's true, so it rings really personally. And it's kind of about the death of her father and the trauma that her uncle went through while he was still in Haiti. So it's a really good read for a good sweep of Haitian history through the eyes of her uncle, and also just for the fact that she's a great writer.
Oh, I totally second that. It was great. And I actually got to see her talk about the book a little bit, and it was really wonderful to see her give a sense of place of Haiti and what it was like during that time.
Yeah.
And especially, yeah, go ahead.
I'm jealous. I wish I could see her speak.
Oh, she's amazing. She's an extremely elegant speaker and just mm-hmm. beautiful speaker. But anyway, okay. Well, my shout out this week is for The Myth of the Rational Market, which coincidentally enough happens to be our book of the month. I haven't actually finished it yet, but I'm in the process of reading it, and I'm enjoying it thus far. And the author, Justin Fox, is really great at placing the economists that he writes about kind of within the context of their time. And they seem more like real people than brains. And of the numbers and the market concepts, he does a decent job of explaining, although I did find I had to reread a few pages just to get what he was saying. And it is a bit of a dense book. So if you haven't quite finished it in time for the discussion on the 22nd of January, it's okay. You can jump in anyway, because it's not like it has a plot where you have to read the ending to be able to talk about it. But that's fine. GD, do you have a shout out?
I want to shout out the first Post Bougie podcast, which we've been messing around with and tinkering with on behind the scenes for a minute now, and trying to get the kinks out. I just want to thank you guys for being such good blog mates and friends over the last however long it's been. I love you like play cousins. That's all.
You're all right. Okay. Well, that'll do it for this week's podcast.
Yeah, seriously, I love y'all. I do.
Anyway,
I do.
I feel like I should sing Aerosmith right now or something.
Yeah, you should. You should.
God, yeah. Jamel.
Wouldn't that be ironic?
So that'll do it for this week's
podcast. I love you, Shani. Sorry. All right.
I can't right now. It's too late for this. All right. Thank you for listening to the first Post Bougie podcast. Hopefully you'll return for the next one.
I think we can leave it there.
On behalf of GD, Monica, and Jamel, this is Shania, and we'll catch you next time. Done.
Our theme music is 8 by Aeon. You can catch us at postbougie.com.